From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Maybe you remember the news reports from several years ago when somebody spotted a coyote in New York Central Park. And people were like, how did a coyote end up in Central Park? Or in Chicago when one was spotted there? Or San Francisco? Well, the biologist Dan Flores says this is not really new. Coyotes, he says, have been on the move for hundreds of years now. They can make a life in the most surprising places. And there are reasons for this, Flores says. One of them is they're a lot like humans. They're smart and flexible. And here's another. They've followed us. They've evolved right alongside humans. And they've succeeded despite the fact we kill something like 500,000 of them a year. Today in the program, Dan Flores is joining us to talk about his new book, what he calls a coyote biography, after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When's the last time you saw a coyote? If you live here in the West, it probably wasn't that long ago. They're pretty common in the foothills above Salt Lake City. Maybe you've seen them roaming your neighborhood. And coyote sightings are not just a Western thing, of course, because these animals are everywhere these days. In his new book, the writer and biologist Dan Flores talks about how by the 1930s, coyotes had managed to add about 2,000 miles to their southern and northern ranges. And since then, they've shown up on the West Coast, they show up the East Coast, they're in Ontario and Portland, Seattle. And all of this despite the fact that humans are constantly trying to kill them. Flores estimates in his book something like 500,000 coyotes are killed a year. He says, in about the time it takes to read a page from his book, someone somewhere is ending the life of a coyote. And why? Why are these creatures so successful despite all of that? Well, Flores says in his book that the starting point is this. Coyotes have never been solely wilderness creatures, that they've evolved alongside humans. And so in that sense, he says they're avatars for humans, stand-ins to help us see ourselves. His book is Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History, and Dan Flores is joining us today to talk about it. He's the A.B. Hammond Professor Emeritus of Western History at the University of Montana. He's written numerous books on aspects of Western U.S. history, and he's joining us today from a studio in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where he lives. And Dan Flores, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
It's a great pleasure to be here, Doug. Thank you for having me on.
Well, let's begin with something you've talked about, and that is that you've been preparing to write this book since you were 12 years old. And I wanted to start there because you grew up in a place where you wouldn't think there would be any coyotes. You grew up in Louisiana.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that no doubt has a lot to do with my fascination with these animals because as a kid, the only place I saw coyotes was on Saturday morning television in the Roadrunner coyote cartoons. And in Walt Disney's films, six of which he did in the 1960s and 70s that I think converted a lot of Americans to a more sympathetic kind of attitude towards them.
You tell the story, and I want to have you read this section from the book, because you tell about your first encounter, kind of surprising encounter with a coyote. Set this up for us and read this section for us, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. At the moment of this moment in time of this story, I was 14 years old, and I had, as I said, been exposed to coyotes through popular media. I knew they were Western animals. I thought of them as creatures of the far deserts of the West, and I was fascinated with them because of what I had seen on television, and fascinated enough with them that I was intrigued by whatever predators might be around where I was growing up in Louisiana. And I had actually had my parents at one point stop the car when I saw a gray fox hit by an automobile and lying on the side of the road so I could get out and take a close look at this animal. So a few weeks after that experience, I had a hardware store owner tell me, you should buy this this new call we've got. It's a dying rabbit call, and you might be able to call up a gray fox since you're so interested in them. So I took that call out within a day or two, rode my bicycle out into the woods, climbed up in an old abandoned deer stand, and after a few seconds, decided to experiment with it. And this is the story I think you'd like me to tell. This is in one of the later chapters of Coyote America. Pointed ears up, gaze fixed, an animal was coming straight as an arrow's flight for the base of the tree I was in. About 30 yards away, where mid-morning sunlight dappled the clearing in light and shadow, it stopped, peered intently in my direction for a few seconds, then resumed its approach, now in a slow, more cautious walk. I'd gotten out of the car and examined that highway-killed gray fox. This was no gray fox. Even through the veil of excitement, I registered clear visual impressions. Sharply pointed ears, a long snout, yellowish and reddish fur that rippled in the sunlight as it approached, eyes that appeared almost orange. Most of all, the impression I never forgot, it was coming toward me on remarkably long legs, like it was walking on stilts. I had a dog at home, a shepherd mix that I knew weighed 50 pounds. This creature was easily that heavy, I guessed, but it seemed much taller, and now it was only 25 feet away. Every second from the moment I'd put the wooden call to my lips had seemed to transpire in slow motion, as if we were underwater. But in an instant, something broke the spell. Probably it was a downdraft swirl of air that sent it a whiff of me. But curiosity on that canine face changed to alarm faster than I could track it. Next I knew, it was loping back the way it had come, its head turned backward toward me the whole time, scanning the forest for the source of the danger. In about the same 10 seconds it had taken to appear, it disappeared, leaving me sitting in a tree, shaking like a leaf. The whole episode had unfolded across less than 2 minutes.
I guess you realize now just how crazy rare it was that you saw a coyote in those days.
It seemed to me like rounding a corner on Bourbon Street in New Orleans and running head-on into a moose on the street. Right. It was one of the most startling experiences of my life, and it sent me home that night to write a letter to Louisiana Fish and Wildlife to tell them about this animal that I had seen. And what I thought it was, particularly because of the size of it, was a wolf. And so I got a letter back in a couple of weeks that said, well, you might have seen a wolf. There are still some red wolves in Louisiana, especially in the part of the state you're in. But more than likely what you saw was a coyote, because coyotes are now colonizing Louisiana.
Yeah.
And I mean, I will confess, I was absolutely stunned beyond imagining by that news. I couldn't imagine why coyotes would be hundreds of miles east of where I thought they should be on the landscape. And that kind of set in motion, I think, the genesis of this book, which is much about trying to figure out the answer to that story.
You know, it's interesting. There are a number of books, and good ones, about the folk stories and myths in Native culture, for example, about coyotes. But
indeed,
your book, you sort of pay homage to those kinds of books, but your book does something different. You're trying to follow a kind of a path of the coyote. Explain what you're – because you describe the book as a biography, a coyote biography. Explain what you're trying to do with the book.
I do call it a biography, and I've had people say, you know, I've never heard of a biography of an animal, of a species. And I think I used that term. I didn't come to that term until well into the project and began to realize what I was doing. But really what I ended up attempting with this book was to tell the story of an animal from its evolutionary origins, from its genesis, which happened to be purely in North America, out of a canid family that evolved here. All the jackals, all the wolves, all the wild dogs of the world come out of American roots. But the coyote was an animal that remained in North America. Many of these other animals, jackals left and went to Africa and Asia. Wolves, in fact, spread out of North America and were gone for a couple of million years before they ultimately returned here. But coyotes never left. And so what I tried to do with that story was to track the history of these animals from their evolution through their first encounters with humans and then sort of continue on the trajectory down through time, describing and trying to answer questions that I had mm-hmm. about what had happened in their relationship between people and themselves down to the present day, because their story is an ongoing – it's like our story. It's an ongoing story.
Mm-hmm. Why do humans find predators like coyotes so compelling? In the book, you say it has to do with our genetic memory.
I think it does. I think we instinctively are drawn to predators because we preserve a kind of a genetic memory of a time when we were not only competitor predators ourselves, but we were also prey.
Right.
And I think that's why when we look face to face at an animal like a wolf or a lion or a tiger, there's a kind of riveted sort of mental communication almost between humans and especially good-sized predators, coyote size on up. And I think it's something that we all of our culture living in cities can come close to erasing, but it's not ever going to erase that biological imperative entirely. And yeah. So we do, no doubt, have a special fascination with predators. We linger over them and look at them longer than almost any other kinds of animals.
You write about how, of course, Native Americans have had this special relationship with coyotes for thousands and thousands of years. Europeans, not so long, and it's a big theme in the book. And you write about – you point out that Europeans had a lot of stories, for example, and myths and folk tales about different kinds of predators like wolves, like bears, like foxes. But coyotes, you say, are different for Europeans. Would you explain in what way?
Well, what I was trying to get at with those passages and with – grappling with why those of us of European backgrounds reacted to them the way we did is that they were completely unfamiliar animals to us, because coyotes evolved in North America and remained in North America. Unlike wolves, they didn't spread around the world. Yeah. Europeans came to the continent 500 years ago with no preconceptions about coyotes. They had indeed no idea that such an animal existed. And as you mentioned, we did come with folk tales and fables about foxes and wolves and bears and any number of other animals. But coyotes were something new, and we didn't actually encounter them until at least the first recorded encounters don't happen until the 19th century outside the Spanish Southwest. The first Anglo-Americans who encounter coyotes and write a description of them were Lewis and Clark in September of 1804, and they – or 1805, I mean. And they basically reacted to them at first thinking that they were – this was some kind of new fox that they were seeing. Right. And then after William Clark – managed to shoot one and had it on the grass in front of him, he realized this animal was not a fox. In fact, it was some variety of wolf, a small version of a wolf. And so he suggested in his journal, and everyone else in the expedition followed suit, that they call the animal a prairie wolf. And indeed, for most of the 19th century, that in fact is what Americans called coyotes. The prairie wolf name persisted. I've seen use of it as late as 1916. It's still on the lips and in the minds of some people. But It in another story that I tell in the book, it gradually that name begins to get replaced by this thousand-year-old Aztec name for the animal, which derives from a word the Aztecs pronounced coyote, and that took several forms depending on who was pronouncing it later in the 19th century.
We'll come back to this, but you mentioning the name raises a point that you make early in the book, and you talk about how that persecuting an animal in a battle you cannot win, which is sort of the story you tell. You say, you know, we've been trying to kill off coyotes for hundreds of years now, can't figure it out, have never been able to for different reasons, which we'll talk about. But you say that's an act of political ideology. And you even say, even the way we pronounce the name. Now, I pronounce it coyote. Other people pronounce it coyote. But you say even in that pronunciation, that's fraught with this kind of political baggage. In some ways, this is how you describe it in the book, the way we pronounce it. You say it's a diagnostic almost of this whole range of belief systems and values. Would you break that down for us? Talk about that.
Yes, I think the pronunciation is. I mean, I tracked down the origins of the different pronunciations of the name in the book. But as a friend has mentioned to me recently, and he's a writer, television personality, and also a hunter. One of the things he said to me when we were talking about this, he said, "Well, you know, anybody who ever kills this animal calls it a coyote."
Right.
And of course, he's exactly right, really. I mean, it's the two-syllable pronunciation is a rural one associated with the rural West, the rural Midwest, the rural South. The three-syllable pronunciation is often associated with urban places and many times with people who are advocates for or at least appreciators of the animals. And so it literally almost becomes, not in every sense to be sure, it's not a hard and fast rule,
sure,
but as kind of a general rule, those two pronunciations represent different opinions about the animal.
You tell the story when you were going to speak at some society or another in Nebraska. Would you talk a little bit about that story? Because they wanted you to say pronounce the name in a certain way.
Yes, they did. And so I was invited a few years ago when I was first working on this book to do a talk in honor of a very famous Great Plains woman writer and the society that kept her memory alive and her work alive asked me to come and speak. They did an annual lecture. And so I agreed to do so, and whenever the member of the board of this group said, "What would you like to talk about?" And I said, "Well, I'm working on a book on coyotes, so how about I talk about coyotes and their history and their relationship to us?" And there was a long pause on the other end of the phone. This was in Nebraska,
yeah.
And the woman finally said to me, "Well, let me go to the board and ask them about that topic." But she added, "If we let you do that, could you please pronounce the animal's name coyote?" And I sort of had an indication at that point that they probably weren't going to approve of a talk on coyotes as a topic, and indeed they didn't. I ended up doing a talk on something very different that never mentioned this animal that clearly had prickled their board.
It's interesting. You say that it's probably fair to say that they're the most persecuted animal in human history. I think that's how you put it, something like that in the book.
Yeah, I do.
But here's
certainly
the thing, though. Here's the thing, though, Dan. Not wolves, because you would think that, you know, wolves have been decimated and killed. But it raises the questions, and maybe even, and I always wondered this about wolves too. Why is it that we hate them so much? Fascinated by them on some level, but why do we? Do you think you figured that out at this point?
Well, I'm not sure that I have an explanation that will satisfy everyone. I mean, I think I've I've figured answers to questions like that out enough to satisfy my own historical investigation of all this. And I think in terms of the wolf issue, one of the things has to do with this long experience that Europeans and people, especially in southern Europe, among herding cultures, cultures that raise sheep and goats, had with predatory animals. It almost seems as if we were in some kind of very direct competition with wild predators whenever we became pastoral and herding peoples. And so we developed this long tradition in the case of gray wolves in Europe before we ever came to North America, that these were animals that needed extermination, outright eradication from the landscape. And we brought those attitudes over to North America. And by the early 20th century, primarily using poisons like strychnine and the use of a government agency, the Biological Survey, dedicated to the task of eradicating wolves, we managed to pull that off in North America. By the 1920s, we had pretty much obliterated wolves across the American landscape everywhere they were found. But I think the issue with coyotes, and the reason they turn out to be even more persecuted than wolves, is that we couldn't do the same thing with coyotes. I mean, there's a famous instance in Montana, starting at the time of the territorial period in Montana, when the territorial legislature was devoting two-thirds of its annual budget to bounties to kill off wolves and coyotes. The wolf population, I mean, they start out killing 60, 70, 80,000 wolves a year and killing about 30 to 40,000 coyotes a year in the 1890s. By the 1920s, the number of wolves that this program is killing in Montana is down to 5 or 6 or 10 a year, but the number of coyotes is still 35 or 40,000. And so I think what the people who are interested in this kind of eradication program come to realize by the 1920s is that there's something about coyotes that's different from wolves, and somehow these animals are able to survive the best shots we can take at them, the most ruthless poisoning techniques, and yet they remain in the same numbers they were in 40 or 50 years earlier. And that was kind of a critical point, I think, in the story of the war on these two predators in particular.
Well, we'll talk about that particular difference, this fascinating development of this unique social life of the coyote, when we get back from a break. Dan Flores is with us. His book is Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History, joining us from a studio in Santa Fe today. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about coyotes. Throughout human history, we've either loved them or hated them. We've created myths and folktales about them, or trapped and poisoned and shot them. And even the way we pronounce the name we've heard says something about our relationship with them. Dan Flores is joining us today to talk about his book, Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History. So I have to say, one of the most fascinating aspects of the story that you tell is this evolutionary trait, this trait that coyotes develop that has made them so successful. Let's talk a little bit about this, because you say they developed this remarkable adaptation, and it's this unique social life that on one hand they can live solitary lives, or on the other hand, depending on what's going on, they can live in packs. They can be really social. And this seems like, in some ways, Dan Flores, it's kind of like the secret sauce for how coyotes are so successful.
Yes, I think it is. It's called, the biologists call this fission fusion, and it's such an unusual evolutionary adaptation that only a handful of mammals around the world possess this trait. And one of the things, as you know, Doug, from the book that I argue, is that we humans are another mammal species that possess this ability to either cooperate and engage in communal enterprises in order to affect large projects, or if we're pressured to scatter across the landscape in ones and twos and escape large threats. I mean, in our history, we usually had this call this into play, call the fission part into play under the impress of disease epidemics. But with coyotes, it seems to have been something that they evolved as a result of their co-evolution alongside gray wolves. And it was a big dog, little dog relationship. Gray wolves tend to persecute and harass and kill coyotes fairly consistently. And over time, over a million years of coexistence with gray wolves, coyotes developed this ability that they then brought into play when we, about 100 years ago, really in the early teens of the 20th century, began to decide that what we were going to do was to completely exterminate coyotes in North America. And as we brought to bear extermination techniques that were draconian, to say the least, poison after poison to try to wipe them out, and millions of dollars of effort to do so, they employed this fission fusion strategy to escape that kind of persecution. And it's the thing that almost directly not only led them to survive it, but also scattered them across the North American landscape. And so in a lot of respects, I mean, I give coyotes agency for the kind of manifest destiny that they've engaged in, where they've done the reverse of what we did. They've spread from the west into the east and the north and the south too. But I also think that what precipitated that expansion was our persecution of them, and they happen to have an adaptation that enabled them to survive it and, in fact, to almost occupy the very ground we were standing on while we were trying to wipe them out.
It's interesting. I want to talk a little bit more about this what you call this war on wild things. Before we get there, I want to mention Mark Twain, because his role in all of this, I think, is kind of disappointing. It's interesting. So when after the Civil War, when Americans come to settle the West, they start to see coyotes as competitors. As you mentioned, this kind of sense that they're going to go after our herds and flocks, that really, you know, happens. And then you say that Mark Twain provides a description of the coyote in his book Roughing It. And he goes on this comic rant, and it seems like that's kind of burnished the reputation of the coyote in some way. Whereas on one hand, the Native Americans that had always sort of seen them as the trickster god, as this deity, Twain now shifts it and makes them seem like these kind of miserable creatures.
I know, and I'm a great lover of Mark Twain, and I hated to attribute this to him. But what I was trying to do was to understand why, after 15,000 years of living alongside coyotes and essentially turning them, as you mentioned, into a kind of a semi-deity and an avatar of the human condition, whose role in all those great stories of early North America, the coyote god for Indian people, is what the stories are doing. I mean, we call them trickster stories, but really what I argue they're about is they're revealing human nature to the listeners of those stories. And so we have at least 10,000 years of human coyote history where that's the role that coyotes play. And then in the 19th century, European Americans encounter the animal. They don't exactly know what it is. They don't know what to think about it because they haven't brought any kind of preconceptions from Europe with them about coyotes. And so it takes about 50 or 60 years before we begin to form an impression. And unfortunately, it's Mark Twain who gives us that impression in this really wonderful but also unfortunate description of coyotes in Roughing It. I mean, he basically takes an animal that no one knew exactly what to think about and converts it into a creature that all America sort of agrees, because Twain's literature has a long reach. All of America kind of comes to agree. This is a slinking, despicable creature that we ought to, the best thing to do is just to get rid of these things.
Let me read it.
Twain unfortunately plays that role.
Yeah. Let me read a section, because you quote Twain in the book. The coyote is a long, slim, sick, and sorry-looking skeleton with a gray wolf skin stretched over it. A living, breathing allegory of want. That's amazing.
I know. And he goes on for 2.5 pages, too.
That's
as he warms
right.
to the task, it
That's
gets
right.
even worse.
Well, so another thing you point out, I had never really thought about this, because, you know, when I go hiking in the foothills, at least certainly at dusk, I can hear coyotes all the time. And you mentioned the different reactions that humans have had over time to that howl. Some see it as lunatic and alien and blood-curdling, and I guess this has contributed to the reputation over time.
I think it has, and I do quote some of the reactions to this howl, which, as you know, I argue is the original national anthem of North America. I mean, they've been singing this national anthem for a million years. But when we heard it, we heard something different. It was alien. It was manic. Mm-hmm. It was chilling. And people said, you know, once the coyotes began at night, I mean, you sat shivering by the fire, unable to go to sleep, or you were awakened in your bed and couldn't go back to sleep. I mean, those kinds of reactions seem to me to be those of a people, Americans in this case, who hadn't yet come to terms with the fact that they were of this continent now. And this is an animal that, I mean, the more you know about this animal, I think the more American you become, because this is a distinctively native creature to this place. But a lot of folks out of the European backgrounds of the 19th century really reacted badly to hearing coyotes howl.
It leads us to that moment you were referring to before, that where this war on wild things, as you put it, kicks in. And we're killing a lot of animals in this time. Would you give us a kind of a scope of the killing that's going on? And there's this market for coyote skins.
There is. Yeah.
Would just give us a sense of this, which is kind of disturbing, but it's the reality.
It is a disturbing historical story. But it's part of our lineage here. I wrote a book published recently called American Serengeti about the large animals of the American Great Plains. And the statistics I used in that book, and I'll add the coyotes to this from the book we're talking about, but in the period from about 1840 through 1920 or so, that's only 80 years' time, we managed to eradicate between 25 and 30 million bison on the Great Plains, between about 12 and 15 million pronghorn antelope, probably close to 50,000 grizzly bears, about 1.5 to 2 million gray wolves, probably as many as 3 million wild horses were either shot or rounded up and sold as dog food. I mean, we basically launched a war of obliteration on the Great Plains to convert this landscape that at one time had been one of the great wildlife spectacles of the world, on a par with East Africa, into this kind of ruinous slate, this place with none of its original characters left. And of course, what we created was what we call today flyover country.
Yeah.
With all those animals gone, I mean, the Great Plains became a very uninteresting part of the United States. Coyotes were right there in the mix because they were one of the animals, like wolves, for example, that were hunted primarily for their pelts. And we don't really know how many of them were killed in those days. Nobody has a good estimate, but the figures went into, no question, millions upon millions of them. In fact, they were such a commonly hunted animal for fur that their pelts actually became currency. They were worth a dollar apiece, and traders exchanged coyote pelts in the 19th century the way people on the eastern seaboard exchanged dollars.
It's interesting. You write about how at first coyotes were not afraid of humans, so they were pretty easy pickings at first. But they're smart, and they quickly figured it out, became really elusive. And this is kind of when the poisoning begins. And you write about, you mentioned strychnine. Do you want to say something? I know this is, it's awful, but what's it like, Dan Flores, to die of strychnine poisoning?
Well, one of the descriptions of a landscape littered with the carcasses of animals, especially predators like coyotes that have been killed by strychnine, is that at a glance and from a distance, you can instantly see the characteristic signature pose that these animals went into in their death throes. And the phrase I use in the book is that they died like shaped like question marks, with their tails stuck straight out like they had been electrocuted or struck by lightning, and their backs wrenched into a bow. And so these trappers who operating for the Biological Survey in the 20s and 30s began trying to exterminate coyotes could top a hill and in an instant look out across a landscape and see how many animals they had gotten with their baits by spotting that signature sort of convulsed kind of frozen death that coyotes and wolves too went through when they were poisoned by strychnine.
Dan Flores is with us. His new book is Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History. We'll take another break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Dan Flores. We're talking about his book, Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History. I want to ask you about this facility in northern Utah, the Predator Research Facility. It's yes. Operated by the Wildlife Service, and some of the experimentation going on there. Not easy to get to. It's sort of tucked away. Would you mention what you found about this place?
Well, it's a very intriguing facility, and I wanted to go there because I wanted to talk to the contemporary scientists who are working with Wildlife Services, which is the federal agency that is the successor to the Biological Survey of the early 20th century. In its task of predator control, primarily acting on behalf of the livestock industry. So I wanted to talk to the scientists there because I had tracked the story of these kinds of labs from the early 1920s. The very first one was founded in 1921 in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and it was called the Eradication Methods Lab. Right. And what the Eradication Methods Lab was all about was inventing ever newer and more effective poisons. As we learn more about coyote natural history and we realize how smart they were, one of the strategies that these labs used was to try to come up with poisons that didn't kill them immediately, because they realized if you used a poison that killed a coyote at once, other coyotes in the area were so smart that they would avoid that poison. And so what we eventually came up with by the 1940s, as a result really of the technological developments of World War II, we came up with a whole host of poisons that tended to kill coyotes fairly slowly so that the coyotes who observed wouldn't draw a kind of an immediate kind of cause-effect relationship. So I was interested in all that naturally because I tracked it from this eradication methods lab from the early 20s. And I knew that the Predator Research Facility outside Logan was kind of the spiritual inheritor of this tradition. And so I arranged for an interview with the scientists there and spent a very educational afternoon. They gave me about 4 hours actually to talk to them as good government servants. And as I say in the book, I found that I enjoyed talking to these people. I enjoyed them. I understood where they came from in terms of their graduate training. But what I kept pushing towards in the course of the interview was to see if they were getting closer to recognizing that there were other interest groups out there aside just from the livestock industry that wanted to weigh in on predator and coyote control, and if indeed they were pushing closer to non-lethal methods. In other words, not having to simply go out and kill every coyote that was suspected of being in trouble. And I didn't get much satisfaction on that score. I mean, we certainly had a good conversation about the possibilities of sterilizing coyotes, but sterilizing coyotes, as the scientists told me, is very expensive. And the truth is the livestock industry is not really much interested in it because they're perfectly content to have wildlife services go out and fly an airplane or a helicopter after a coyote that they think is a troublemaker and taking it out. And mm-hmm. so the result today is that wildlife services still kills about 80,000 coyotes a year, mostly using aircraft, although there is some limited use of poisons now. And so the result is this has become an agency with its single constituency that has really attracted a lot of bad press. I mean, there are just tons of essays and articles out there from Conservation Biology's journal to the New York Times, the Washington Post, where Wildlife Services comes in for a pretty severe scathing.
56 million sheep on U.S. pastures in the 1940s. 56 million. Now something like 6 million. And there's still this intent. This is these are figures from your book. And you've also come to this conclusion, Dan Flores, you say that by talking to those people at the Predator Research Facility, you've come to believe that they're pretty aware that poisons and traps and, you know, shooting from the air is never going to reduce coyote populations anywhere, and which raises the question, why then do they still do it if it has no effect?
Yeah, well, and they do know it in part because, I mean, the person who founded the modern facility near Logan, Fred Knowlton was his name, very famous biologist, participated in a study that dates back to the early 1960s, where biologists began to run computer modeling on what they knew about how coyotes responded to pressure. And what they discovered was, it's one of the most startling things I uncovered in doing the research for this book. What they realized, and what all these scientists at the Predator Research Facility know full well, is that you can reduce a local population of coyotes by 70%, 7 out of 10 of them, year after year after year, and their numbers do not diminish one iota. And so there are very few animals that if you have the knowledge that we can take out 70% of them year after year after year, and we're not going to have any effect whatsoever on them, that's one of the reasons I argue that this is an ideological war. It's not a war based on a logical understanding of science or of coyote natural history or of coyote evolution or anything like that. It's an ideological war that we have to keep on participating in because there's a constituency out there that demands that wildlife services do something. And killing them seems to be what they want this government agency to do. And so they simply continue on in the same vein year after year. Meanwhile, as more and more Americans, having grasped what biologists and ecologists have explained to us about the role of predators in the world and about the long history, the deep history of North America before we ever got here, many people simply think it's hubris to do something like this. It's almost as if we come to North America and decide the place has just not been properly weeded yet. And so we're going to take it into our hands to do so. So it's a war with no end, a war that at one time was compared to our wars against Hitler and Japan, and earlier to the Russian Revolution, when coyotes were referred to as the original Bolshevik. But we just keep going on with it because somehow we can't find an off-ramp, some way to get out of it.
I want to come back to that point here in a moment, but I want to ask you about something that you mentioned earlier, this idea that the coyote in many ways personifies the full suite of humanity's traits. In the book, you write about one of the big differences between the histories of coyotes and humans is humans, on one hand, have created thousands of these, you know, religious philosophies. Coyotes, in contrast, and we have a lot in common, of course, down the way, but coyotes, in contrast, are just there. They're just alive. And in that sense, you say that the coyote sort of represents something extremely fundamental. Would you explain that?
I tell a story in one of the chapters of the book about a biologist named Adolf Murie, who, among people who know the environmental history of North America, they know this is a very famous biologist. But at the time, he was a young man, and he was employed by the National Park Service. And Congress had just a few years earlier passed what was called the Animal Damage Control Act, which was the act that essentially appropriated $10 million for the Bureau of Biological Survey to exterminate coyotes. And Adolf Murie was sent into Yellowstone in the late 1930s, essentially to gather the science to buttress this notion of coyote extermination. I mean, amazingly enough, we passed the Animal Damage Control Act without any science to precede it. And so in the wake of the passage of this Extermination Act, people like Adolf Murie are sent out to gather the evidence to support it. Adolf Murie was one of those scientists who thought that above all, scientists have to be ethical. And so the ultimate result of his report was he concluded that coyotes are by no means the arch predator of our time, as the Bureau was calling them. And they were not a threat to game animals. Indeed, they had co-evolved with pronghorns and bighorn sheep and mule deer for millions of years. And so they were no threat to those animals. But he also had this experience, and this is why I wanted to tell this story. It speaks to the point you're making about what coyote religion is, if there is indeed such a thing. Murie was standing beside a game trail one morning in Yellowstone, and he saw a coyote coming, trotting down the trail. And so he remained very still. The animal didn't see him. And as it approached him, Murie could see that it was doing something really unusual. And finally, as it got closer, he realized the coyote had a sprig of sagebrush in its mouth. And at intervals, it was tossing the sprig into the air, adroitly catching it trotting a few more feet, tossing it into the air, catching it again. And as Murray watched, the animal went completely out of sight, still enjoying this little game of catch. And so as Murray stood there and thought about that, what he realized was that he was witnessing an animal that was taking tremendous joy in the simple act of being alive. And that really struck home with him, and it struck home with me. It's the reason I tell the story in the book, because I wanted people to realize that what these animals have by way of, if we could call it a religion, is simply the joy, pure joy in simple existence in the world. And it seems to me that's fundamental, that's elemental, that's at the core of what life's experiences are all about. And if it takes a coyote to teach us that that's what is fundamental in our lives, then I think, as people have been doing for 10,000 years, we need to pay really close attention to these animals.
That's Dan Flores. His book is Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History. He joined us from Santa Fe, New Mexico, where he lives. Dan Flores, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug. I appreciate it.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Tim Slover. Tony Liu is our intern. Josh Weathers, producer for Video West. Radio West, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.